Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and I have a special treat for you all this week. You're going to get a sneak preview of Writers After Dark with an interview with Top Cow writer Zach Kaplan, whose new series, Porter of Earth, just came out with its first collection, and issue number 5 will be hitting the stands May 9th, so in time for next week's new comic book day. And stick around afterwards, because we have a second interview. We caught up with Robert Sheehan of Bad Samaritan during a press junket, and contributor Joelle Monique got an awesome, awesome interview with him. But right now, here's the interview with Zach. And welcome there, Writers After Dark. We're here to talk stories. All good stories start with writers, and that's who we're talking to. The novelists, the comics writers, the screenwriters, the playwrights. Wherever there's a story, there's someone either making it up or writing it down. And my guest today is Zach Kaplan, a comics writer of a very, very cool new... Well, it's not actually very new. The Issue 1 came out in November, but the 4-volume collection just came out. And Port of Earth is the story. And I'm going to let Zach tell all of us what it's about. Hi, Zach.
Hi. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Tell us what Port of Earth is.
Port of Earth poses the question, what would happen if aliens came not to blow us up, like they always do in movies and TV and pop culture, but what if they came to Earth with a business deal? And the business deal is they want to build a port here on Earth. So it's a unique spin on the alien arrival story, and it focuses on business and capitalism and immigration, and it's very kind of current, modern take on aliens coming. They build a port here on Earth. The aliens don't always stay at port. It turns out we thought we were making a deal with the United Nations of the galaxy, and we've made a deal with Chevron of the galaxy. And so the aliens, visitors that are passing through, they sometimes have different points of view and perspectives and beliefs and operating ways they deal with life and rules, and they don't always stay at port, and sometimes they come and cause problems for human beings, or kill human beings, or there's misunderstandings. So we've had to form an agency called the Earth Security Agency that's responsible for maintaining the peace between alien visitors and human beings. So it's a very grounded kind of, a lot of people draw parallels to Men in Black potentially, but this is definitely a grittier modern version. And that's Port of Earth.
The story is very interesting, and I wouldn't have called it a new version of Men in Black, because everybody on the planet knows about the aliens. Everybody on the planet knows that the aliens are supposed to stay in the port, not interact with people.
Yes.
And problems ensue when aliens break those rules. And so I would have pitched it as NCIS Galactic, but hey.
Sure. There you go. I like that too.
Just because you're trying to control something that is beyond our technological capabilities to control. These are sentient beings, sentient races from other worlds who have the capability of interstellar travel, and we're just a backwater gas station.
That's right. And a lot of people get really excited to kind of learn more about the galaxy and the greater world, because after first contact, that's your instinct as to, well, who's out there? And we don't get that opportunity. This kind of says it's very possible that we could actually make a deal, build an alien port, have aliens coming going, and still be completely in the dark as to the politics, the various races, all the answers of the galaxy and life that we're hoping to. Maybe we're just left as a gas port, essentially, and we don't get all the answers, and we're kind of left in the dark. And it feels very authentic to me.
Especially where you have the economics of the situation, where everybody, the way you portrayed it, unemployment on a global scale is at unprecedented levels.
Yeah,
But
let
you
me set this up.
have,
Yeah,
yeah,
for
go
your
ahead.
listeners. So the deal, the exchange, actually, what we get in return is the alien group that comes offers us advanced technology in the form of essentially a water engine. They all the ships run on water. That's why they or can run on water. That's why they want our planet. And they say, hey, we'll give you the very technology that a lot of these ships use to turn water into energy. And we think we're going to end our energy crisis overnight. And I like to kind of really get into the guts of these things. And so I said, well, sure, okay, we do that, but what would that sudden economic shift do? And I proposed that it might disrupt everything, and you'd have millions of people who were working in all these other energy sectors, even solar and wind, car mechanics, everybody just out of work, and it would be actually, we think we're getting something, and maybe it backfires on us. So yeah, I really the book constantly tries to look at every layer I possibly can in this science fiction question, and what might be the real world ramifications.
So, how much real world exemplars are you pulling into this story? Because when I started reading it, the first thing that popped into my mind were all those stories about multinational corporations going into remote areas in South America and basically killing indigenous people, kicking tribes off their land, and just taking the resources for themselves. And they had already bought the courts down there, so there was no recourse for these people to keep their land, their ancestral land that they've had for thousands of years. The logging rights, the mineral rights, the oil rights, all of it's just taken away from them and given to other people. I'm like, oh my, we're going there. Cool.
Yeah, I'm so glad you got that and you went there, because yeah, it's definitely meant to inspire the early moments of colonialism, whether it's imperial colonialism or corporate colonialism. But this notion that advanced civilization, meeting less advanced, often one group gets taken advantage of, and there's exploitation, and there's very little that the exploited group can do, but kind of go along and hope for the best, and it isn't warships showing up, but it's a slow bleed of exploitation and misuse, and just, the interests are not really being equally met. And so yeah, here come alien businessmen with a deal, and absolutely, there's this very thick layer of this colonialism happening very slowly, and so the book is meant to inspire that. As I'm glad that you thought that you thought of that.
As soon as I got to the one panel where the various human rights organizations around the world were purposefully kept out of the negotiations, I'm like, oh, this isn't going to end well.
Yeah, and the book continues to dig that hole, and you get the sense more and more that the people who are in business with this alien consortium have inevitably fallen into the trap of looking out for their own interests at the expense of the planet. But it's kind of this dual argument, because the people who are working with this alien consortium, their point of view is this: these aliens were going to take what they wanted no matter what. And so they rationalize all of this with the argument, we're trying to manage this the best way we possibly can. And I do believe that when you look at examples like you mentioned in South America, or you look at Western entities coming into the Middle East, or European entities coming to the New World, there's always part of the native population that tries to reasonably deal, and those parties usually benefit the most. But they kind of look at the argument, what choice do we have but to try to profit as best we can and hopefully make out. But I'm never trying in the book to show off someone purely as being greedy, and there's this structure in the – we follow the agents on the ground, but there's also a news interview going on between a journalist and the head of the Earth Security Agency. And he kind of has a witty retort for everything, which is meant to feel very modern in and of itself in terms of all the spin that goes on in the news. But he has several good points, you know, that this deal is going to happen, and what were we to do? And for every time they say, well, you know, you let all these groups, all these corporations, you know, set up shop and take advantage of this deal, he says they were the best suited to. And so there's always this just enough truth that you kind of, you know, understand, but it's clearly a level of corruption and a level of misuse. And it's, like I said, it's very modern.
It's extremely modern. And I'm curious to see what happens as the story continues. Like I said, the collection of the first four issues just came out, and that is the way the head of the ESA just kept saying, this is the best deal we could make, this is the best deal we could make. You know, I'm curious, was this deal made at the point of a gun, you know, kind of like, you know, your signature will be on the contract or your brains will, kind of Godfather style?
I think it's more insidious than that. And I think that it's just evaluating that you have aliens that have entered our atmosphere with massive warships, extremely advanced technology. And they say, we're interested in your planet, we're interested in this, we have this deal for you. And, you know, when our politicians and our leaders go off to evaluate the situation, they must do a risk assessment of, well, what happens if we say no, and, you know, you're in the dark here, and you just don't say no. And so you just sit down at the table and try to make the best deal you possibly can. And that's what's happened all throughout human history. I think one of the things I come back to in the series is to try to make the aliens seem as human as possible. And so that for every trap that human beings, or for every aggressive overture that human beings have ever done in these moments in human history where two civilizations meet, I assign as much human behavior to the aliens. The aliens come in and they don't need to strong arm or use a gun per se, because they're riding on horses and they've got guns, and, you know, we have spears and bows and arrows, and it's just quite clearly a situation where we're going to have to make a deal. But, you know, the first four issues really set the groundwork that we have the second arc coming out. Actually, this next, what is it, May 9th, mm-hmm. Issue 5 comes out, and that kicks off the second arc. And I'm really excited because I continue to try to peel back as many layers as I can in terms of looking at all the ways in which this unfolded, and also to try to look more at the emotional toll that these agents take, trying to balance between the protecting human lives and essentially protecting the deal itself. And because when you come to a situation where you have an alien visitor and human beings who are at odds in some way, to turn on the alien visitor, who's the customer of the port, invariably jeopardizes the deal. So our human agents find themselves in a very dicey predicament that wears on them. So I really have a lot of fun looking at that.
Nice. I'm looking forward to the second arc. Now, you and your artist, Andrea Moody, you guys are doing something interesting. You're doing four issues at a time, and each segment of four issues is itself like a chapter of a larger book. So the collection for one through four came out. Chapter five or issue five starts in May for another four issues, and then we have another arc that starts after that. How did that structure come about?
You know, the publisher is Image Comics, and the imprint is Top Cow. And Image and Top Cow always vary. A Top Cow likes to do four issues, and so I just fell into that number of issues for a graphic novel because that was the publisher. But I like it because it makes for a very snappy, succinct read, and I try to pack as much as I possibly can in there. And yeah, the structure for me was always to try to tell this story. And actually, so issues one through four start with these two agents, and issues five through eight are actually going to end with this story of these two agents. And as the series will continue, I want to continue to rotate the perspective, so to speak, and look at other aspects of the Port of Earth situation that we have. So I'm really enjoying kind of traveling around the narrative, and ultimately for me, and this was a very interesting device, was to try to make the reader feel like they were watching this all unfold in the news, and kind of in a way, in the same way we watch some of the dramas unfold in the news today, that we're kind of also the protagonists. That you have these agents who are protagonists and who are experiencing this very classic action track down the alien storyline and the ups and downs there. But we're kind of watching all this unfold as a planet and kind of wondering, well, what's our fate in all this, and how is the drama with this Port of Earth going to play out? Are we going to continue to be subject to this exploitation and this situation, or are we going to find a way to extradite ourselves from this situation? Can this get better, or can it only get worse?
How does this, the way the storytelling is broken up, how does that affect how you and Andrea work to put these together? Do you have breaks where you get to brainstorm about what's coming next? Do you or work on other projects in between? How is that structured?
Well, no, we're both actually working on other projects simultaneously, and we definitely communicate a lot and collaborate in terms of the storytelling. One thing that I did actually was divide the way in which I addressed the two different narrative structures. So the one narrative structure is the two agents, and the other narrative structure is the interview. And for me, it was very important that the interview felt as much as it kind of has its own story each issue, I needed that interview to feel as unified and connected and dramatic as possible. So there were moments where I said, hey, here's the agents portion of the story, but I'm still working on the interview portion of the story. Or here's the interview for two issues, because I did it, I worked on it simultaneously. So yeah, we go back and forth a lot. But ultimately, just in the nature of comics, I'm writing an issue, and then while he's drawing that issue, I'm writing the next one, and then once he's drawn it, it's handed over to the colorist, and Vladimir Popov, the colorist, colors it, and then we get it lettered. And so there's this little bit of a conveyor belt. But yeah, and we definitely at the end of the first four issues, we broke and talked about the story. I'd say the most collaboration, though, takes place at the What took place at the onset of the series, kind of when we sat down and said, well, what's everything going to look like? Here's the idea, and I shared as much as I possibly could with him. And so we had to talk about how the aliens are going to look like. And I said, I wanted all rules out the window. I didn't want anything that didn't make scientific sense, but maybe there are some aliens that can't breathe in our atmosphere. Maybe there are aliens that need devices to magnetic devices to move around. They're floating off if they don't, have something weighing them down. And there can be all sorts of funky shapes and designs. And I think Andrea had a ton of fun playing with all the different alien designs. We even put a lot of those in the back of the book and the ships and everything. We definitely said this was not a Star Trek universe where everybody was humanoid. We wanted the aliens to definitely be a little more out there.
Yeah, the database of creatures or aliens and their ships, so the different types of ships, was a real treat to go through. I'm a huge fan of Babylon 5, so having
yes.
that historical perspective where not everything looks quite typical or usual to humans is right there in front of your face. So that was a lot of fun.
That's a great reference. Totally. Yes.
Now I have to say, next time you talk to Andrea, give him a golf clap for me, because the covers for issues 4 and issues 5 are gorgeous. They're just breathtaking. This story, I had heard rumors that there was talks of it being optioned. Is there anything you can say towards that?
I can. I can say it has been.
Oh, okay, cool.
But I can't say any more than that. Unfortunately, all the exciting participants behind the deal, and there's some very exciting ones, they're all still busy cooking up things. And so as much as it has been sold to Hollywood, we're still waiting for the official announcement to come out. So I got tired at some point about biting my tongue entirely and decided that I was just going to start saying, yes, it's been bought for Hollywood and it's being adapted for TV, but I can't yet say who's behind it all. So hopefully that news will come out at some point in the near future, but they like to make very splashy announcements and wait for everything to be completely ready. So so until then, that's all I can say.
Cool. We will sit back and bide our time with that. Now, you have another series, Eclipse, that also was optioned, correct?
Yes. Yeah, that's another also secret in terms of how much I can say. But yes, that's also been optioned for television. We're waiting for news of that. But yeah, that was my first series. That premiered in fall of 2016. And we're actually coming back with it with the beginning of the third arc this summer, which I'm very excited about.
That's what I wanted to ask. Is that continuing? And when is that continuation coming? Tell us a little bit about Eclipse.
Eclipse basically is a world where the sun will burn you alive if you go outside. Sunlight's turned deadly. Everybody works at night and sleeps during the day. It's a nocturnal society. They live underground, and there's a killer going around. He's using sunlight to burn his victims. It's up to the hero to stop him. And that's basically where issues 1 through 4 start, and then the story continues to explore the mysteries of how the killer was able to do what he does. And I'm not going to say much more for those who might want to pick it up for the first time, but it's a very cool noir kind of book that kind of flips noir conventions. So day is night, night is day. There's a lot of fun action sequences and thrills with sunlight and sunlight killing people. It's got a lot of twists and turns. It's a lot of fun. The artist Giovanni Timpano is amazing. He gets better with every issue. He's very detailed. For those comic book fans out there, he wants to be the next Jeff Darrow, and he's making a good case for it. And so the third arc comes back. We're going to announce the exact date soon, but I can say it's coming back this summer, and we'll do another 4 issues and then another trade, and I'm hoping to keep that going.
Now, is there anything else you're working on, any new titles coming along, or is Port of Earth your current main focus?
I have a new one coming out. It's so if the Return of Eclipse and Port of Earth second arc ongoing wasn't enough, I have a third book that comes out in June, and that's with the Aftershock Comics, and that's called Lost City Explorers, and that's another fun sci-fi. It's maybe even my most fun kind of idea. It follows a group of millennial teenagers, and they go looking for a secret underneath New York City, urban exploration, archaeology, and supernatural. And it turns out that they find what seems to be a doorway to the lost city of Atlantis, which is underneath Manhattan. And so it's kind of my homage to Goonies, but it's a modern, it takes place in present day. It's a group of teenagers, but they're kind of 17, 18, so it's got a kind of a more adult, mature kind of feel to it. And yeah, it's just a fun adventure. I got really into urban exploration and kind of how cities, especially cities like New York City, have so much myth and mystery kind of just buried underneath their subway tunnels and their sewer systems, and there's just all this history forgotten under there, and so much ancient stuff that we just can never really truly know. And so I kind of took that and combined it with my love for lost cities and Atlantis, and kind of mashed it all together and threw in some science fiction and supernatural. And so yeah, that comes out in June. I'm really excited about that. And then I'm working on a couple new ideas that hopefully I'll have some more stuff for next year. So keeping very busy, which is pretty awesome.
Nice. I'm a huge fan of Josh Gates and his Expedition Unknown and Destination Truth back on Sci-Fi Channel. So just
Yeah.
imagining Goonies mixed with Expedition Unknown has me grinning
Yes,
like a child right
that's
now.
it. You got it.
Oh, I can't wait to check that one out, but I'm when you are ready to announce what can be done, what television station or streaming service we will be able to see Port of Earth on, definitely let us know, because I will direct people to it. Port of Earth just has so much potential, and I cannot wait to see what you guys come up with next.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm very excited about it. It's been amazing, the response. And yeah, I mean, I mean, when I first thought of the idea, I kind of couldn't believe that no one else had explored the idea of an alien arrival from a business standpoint. And so I just think it just inspires something, the idea itself. And it's been so much fun to explore, and the creative team does a fantastic job. And the concept of seeing it on television just seems awesome to me. So it's all very exciting, and Eclipse too. So it's been really an exciting time. I mean, these are my first two comics. I've been publishing comics for a year and a half. Eclipse was my first, Port of Earth was my second. So it's really been a pretty exciting ride so far. So please check them out, and definitely I will come back and let you know when we know more about the TV stuff.
Awesome. Now, tell our listeners where they can find you online.
I'm online on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all of them at Zach Capps, ZackKapps. I have a website that I don't keep up enough, so you can find ZackCapps.com, but it's usually very outdated because I'm too busy writing comics. But yeah, I'm online. I love talking comics. I am by all means, if you check out my stuff, hit me up and tell me what you thought. And yeah.
Excellent. Well, we will send everyone your way, especially when Port of Earth issue 5 comes out May 9th from Top Cow, available at your favorite print and digital comics distributors. Zach, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Slice of Sci-Fi. Hey, Slice of Sci-Fi listeners, I have a little bit of a treat for you now. Many of you may know about the movie Bad Samaritan, directed by Dean Devlin of Stargate and Leverage and The Librarian's fame. He's got a new thriller out this weekend starring David Tennant, who personally is my favorite Doctor Who, but this is a project of love for Dean Devlin, and he filmed it outside of the studio system. His company, Electric Entertainment, is doing the distribution, and we were able to send someone to the Los Angeles Press Junket Day for it, and Joelle Monique actually got a chance to sit down with star Robert Sheehan, who plays the unfortunate lad who comes across a very, very, very angry man, and hijinks ensue. But Joelle has a great interview with Robert for us, so here it is.
All right, man, so you have been working with Dean for a minute now. You guys did Geostorm and now this.
Minute or two, yes.
What has it been like working with him as a director? I mean, he's a prolific producer, clearly knows the industry inside and out.
Yeah, intimately. Well, you have all the benefits of that knowledge when you work with Dean. And both times were two very different experiences. The first one was on that film Geostorm, and it was a great big studio film, lots of bells and whistles, lots of money, but also lots of, I think, creative interference. And so I think the film that Dean set out to make with Geostorm isn't necessarily the film that got made in the end, you know. And we've all heard that story many times. So I think Bad Samaritan was just unfettered enthusiasm on the part of Dean Devlin for the fact that he didn't have to involve a studio, and he could sort of he had the resources to make this film. And so it was two very, very different experiences, really, but you know, first of which I was completely insulated from, and both were really, really good fun, you know, because the first one we shot in NASA in New Orleans, Louisiana, actual NASA. So it's just amazing, you know, getting to experience these things.
Dope. So are you getting a good tour of America with him? Showing you the deep south, upper northern areas?
Upper northern, yeah. Yeah, exactly. I did New Orleans because of Dean, and now Portland because of Dean. So yeah, he's, among other things, he's widening my knowledge of American geography.
When I was talking to Dean, we were talking about sci-fi and the role it plays of being able to contextualize arguments outside of their situations. And I see you've done like a ton of science fiction films and roles and stuff, and I was wondering what connects you to sci-fi, or why do you keep going back to the genre?
Well, I think firstly, what connects me to it, I think, you know, the world is a little bit biased in ways, and when you are connected to that genre, It makes it easier for other people to connect you to that genre, I think, which is a funny thing, isn't it? You
know, yeah, definitely.
Some actors are just more associated with certain genres. It's not necessarily always the case, so I think that helps, because a lot of the stuff, stuff that became popular, excuse me, earlier in my career, was sci-fi. Misfits is a big
one. Definitely.
And the other part of it. Of the question. What was the second half of the question again?
What draws you back to it? I guess maybe you answered that already.
Well, what draws me back, I would say, is that sci-fi, I think, has the opportunity to manifest abstract things literally.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have a lot of fun with that. And it's the stuff that interests me most. It was always the reading material when I was growing up. Was always sort of supernatural or fantastical or sci-fi in some way. I was a huge fan of Isaac Asimov growing up.
Totally.
Huge fan.
So also, as we're talking about sci-fi and your roles here, I know you're going to be in Umbrella Academy soon. Are you a fan of Pete's music? Did you get in through... like him as a writer, and you were excited about like the music and everything going in, or
the music?
Who? Yeah, for Umbrella Academy.
Yeah,
because written by rock star
Gerard Way.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was unaware that he had done the graphic novel, to be
honest. Okay, well.
I found out about that when I got sent the script. And so I went away and read the graphic novel. And I'm not usually one to sort of naturally gravitate to graphic novels, but I've picked up a few over the years and I've really, really enjoyed... I've really enjoyed the ones because it's always come as a recommendation, so it's always a very, very popular one, a very sort of tried and tested, celebrated one, like for example Watchmen.
Yeah.
And so I just came to know of Umbrella Academy because of the script I got sent and the celebration of it, so I went and read it and enjoyed it thoroughly. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Well, we're definitely excited to see you in it.
It's going to be all manner of bonkers.
Yes.
I guarantee you that. Yeah. We're halfway through filming it right now.
Wow, exciting.
Yeah.
Genuinely excited about the book is really good. Mm. I want to ask you too about this role. In the Junkie, you guys were talking a lot about being able to share your own opinions and getting your ideas out there and trying different things with the characters. And it seems kind of like a group effort to not just film the film, but to tell the initial story. And I was wondering specifically with your character, Sean, is it the idea to keep the Irish accent, was that you? And you're like, look, I just don't want to do another accent. Was it, I understand coming to America from Scotland and trying new things. Where did that come into play?
Dean liked me for the role. So he said to Brandon, rewrite the script. And Brandon rewrote it, did a pass where the character was English.
Mm.
And that was the script for a while, and then Dean just, we were talking on the phone, I was in Australia at the time doing another thing, and Dean just went, instead of doing English, you might as well just do it Irish. And I was like, yeah, I mean, I agree completely. So and it's kind of never really been done. I can't think of another example. Maybe Colin Farrell has used his own accent in American movies. I watched him in that movie, The Killing of a Sacred Deer, recently.
God.
Did you see that?
Yes. That and The Lobster from the same director, from some of my favorite movies of the last couple of years.
Yeah, he's certainly a unique dude, isn't he?
He's got a distinct perspective on the world that makes you want to be drawn into his stories and what he's telling and saying. Mm. Not unlike Mr. David Tennant.
Mr. Tennant, exactly, who always brings something very unique and distinctive.
So tell us about this great snowstorm face-off between the two of you guys.
The great snowstorm of 2017.
Yes.
Well, that was an intense couple of days. I think because we're both at the end of our rope, the two characters, so there's an element of desperation that sort of underpins the whole face-off scene at the end.
Definitely. I heard you guys did it in one take.
Oh, really? I can't really remember these things, to be honest. It's weird, because once you see the film, it starts to change your memory from your perspective to the camera's perspective.
Right, through the editor's perspective.
Yeah, so it makes you start to forget your own point of view memory.
Definitely.
A little bit. But if Dino says it's right, Dino's got a brain like a computer, so I wouldn't second guess him on that front.
So there's this moment in the film where you kind of flip gender roles, the shower scene, where it's so rare to see a man in this kind of vulnerable position. Mm. And I think it could, you know, once the film comes out, I have a feeling this film's going to gain some cult like status, just in that it's like such a great serial killer moment for Tennant. It's like a great moment for you, this like hyper drive of fear. And that moment, I think, is kind of the culmination of all of that. Were you like aware of the kind of the reversal of roles there at all?
The reversal of roles.
Just isn't that typically we see it, especially in horror films?
Oh,
it's
you
mostly
mean
women.
It's usually a woman.
Yeah, yeah.
No, actually, funnily now that you say. But it is a very vulnerable place, isn't it, being in a shower and stuff. And it is, you're right, this is an element of it being quite feminizing. Or maybe that's just because we're used to film culture, you know.
Definitely.
Having the lady victim in the shower, i.e. Psycho.
Definitely.
But honestly, it's nice to hear that you're sort of taking that away, because I didn't think of it that way.
Yeah, no, instantly. I kind of found it shocking and then really thrilling, this idea of, I'm so used to just seeing women being hunted through movies, and while, you know, sometimes that's an exquisite journey. A lot of times it just feels pandering and a little bit terrifying.
Yeah.
A little bit triggering. Like.
A little bit misogynistic, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But I heard an interesting talk. Bret Easton Ellis, who's a film intellectual, critic, author, who wrote American Psycho, the mm-hmm. book, and Less Than Zero, and Rules of Attraction, all those good books. And Karen Kusama, the female director.
She is great.
Yeah, and they were talking about Brian De Palma.
Mm.
And how there, you know, there's quite a few rape scenes. There's women being hunted, certainly, in his films. But she loves his work, and mm-hmm. she doesn't see it as misogynistic. And he has been accused of that in the past. And she said, well, what's to say that he isn't the woman in whatever scene? Because you know, his stuff is so interesting and so well-directed that it's often from different perspectives. And I think to instantly assume that because a woman is being sort of raped or hunted or whatever, and it's a male director, mm-hmm. is misogynistic, I think, is to be a little bit reductive
sure.
of the whole thing.
Absolutely. Especially when you consider, I hate when say, well, we shouldn't show these things. Like, this happens on a daily basis, and mm. to ignore it or to not tell those people's stories,
yeah, yeah,
I think is a crime. Certainly you want to tell those stories with respect, and you don't want it to be fetishizing. I think that's where it gets
yeah.
creepy and unnerving, is when that kind of stuff is fetishized and maybe
absolutely.
Sexual as opposed
yeah.
to horrific as it is.
Totally right. And you know, like, I'm working with Mary J. Blige at the moment.
Shut up, on what?
On Umbrella Academy.
I did not know Mary was involved.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And I watched Mudbound.
Yes.
And although it seems really extreme, that film, it's not, because that's the way, you know, that was the type of shit that was happening. And it's just, I mean, I suppose it seems outlandish to our sort of modern day palate, or certainly to mine, maybe because I've lived a somewhat insulated life from those issues. But she's fabulous in it. She's really, really fabulous in it. And you're right, these stories need to be told and reminded and told responsibly, you know, male or female.
Definitely. Throughout the film, you're doing a lot of, like, kind of artsy day jobs, stealing, whatever you can do to survive. As
yep.
A poor kid living in LA currently, I was able to identify with the beg, borrower, steal mentality to get your way through. I was wondering if on your journey to become an actor, I mean, you popped off pretty young, but was there a time of great struggle and doing what you gotta do to get ahead?
It was. Well, never great struggle, but certainly moneyless.
Yeah.
But it didn't seem like a struggle at the time, I suppose, you know, I mean. I think you're a little bit, your sort of whole perspective on money changes when you've only got 100 quid in the bank, you know. But you don't necessarily get panicked, you know. Your kind of initiative and resourcefulness kicks in to some degree, I think, you know, and your wiliness. I remember my mother called me. I was living in Galway City in the west of Ireland. I'd just done a year of university, mm-hmm. and I was supposed to be going into second year. And she sent me, or she called me going, yeah, Rob, a letter's come through. And you failed the repeat examinations. You failed two of them. And I said, oh, right, so what does that mean? And she said, well, it means that you're going to have to either repeat first year or drop out. And I was like, I'll drop out then. There wasn't ever even a question. And, like, my mother's such a saint, because they, you know, they'd spent a fair bit of money and stuff, like, organizing me a place on campus in the university and stuff. And then I just quite arbitrarily on the phone go, no, I'll just drop out. And she said, well, what are you going to do? And I was like, I don't know. I mean, I'll be fine. I have about €350 in my account. And that was literally my attitude. I was like, yeah, I'll be fine. And that sounds like a made up story, but it isn't. That's absolutely true. But I was well young at that point. I was only 18 at that point. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a bit of beg, borrow, steal. Mm. It ain't the worst thing in the world.
As you're growing, I think it's time for one more question. I saw that you've done a fair bit of Shakespeare your past.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a huge Shakespeare buff.
Oh, good on
you. Do you have a favorite Shakespeare sonnet or a character that you would really like to portray in Shakespeare, maybe on the big screen?
Well, I played Richard III on stage.
Yeah.
So doing him on screen would be an absolute dream come true. That would be a fabulous thing. Who else would I like to play in Shakespeare?
That's a tough one. Very tough one.
I mean, I feel like you could have the chops to do a pretty mean Hamlet if you were feeling up for it.
You know, I've never really had a burning desire to play Hamlet, which sounds like sacrilege coming
from an
actor.
You
want to
do the tortured soul?
Yeah.
The guy on the hunt for... No?
I've never related to him that sort of...
You don't seem to harbor a lot of anger in you.
Yeah, I've never fully understood his journey, I think. I've seen many, many versions of Hamlet. But I've never fully understood what's driving him. I mean, it's a very complex play, obviously. I'd like to play... Richard II is beautiful.
Ooh.
Richard II is a very, very complex play. And it's... There are some soliloquies in that are just... It's absolutely mind-bending and beautiful. And but, you know, the longest soliloquy in Shakespeare is Richard III.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes place in the Henry VI trilogy before Richard is Richard III, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And, so I had to do that. I had to do that. And then, can I remember a word of it? No. It was so incredibly long, though.
I'm sure.
Incredibly long. Soliloquy. It was all about, like... It's basically all about him being disgusted at his older brother's behavior, and now his older brother is king, and he's like, what's he doing? And it's just this sort of... It's the beginnings of the frustrations which kind of turn him into the ugly monster of the later play, because he's only a teenager at that point.
Well, I'd love to see you up there on the big screen doing some more Shakespeare.
You know what? I did a short film in Los Angeles before I went and did Wars of the Roses, which was the Shakespeare trilogy.
Yeah.
Henry, Edward, Richard. And because I was practicing, any excuse to practice the text, I was here in Los Angeles living at the time. So I said, you know what we should do? We should do a short film where I do the opening monologue of Richard III as a homeless guy in downtown Los Angeles. And so we did it, and it looks really beautiful.
Where can we find this?
And it broadcast, actually, on Channel 4's Random Acts in November of last year. But, you know, when the time comes, Channel 4 have the right to it at the moment. That's the thing, so it's hard to say. But there will come a time when you know, the rights revert back to us and we'll just put it online.
I got my fingers crossed for you. I want to see that.
It's called Dickie.
Dickie.
Yeah.
I'm going to look it up. Thank you for your time, Robert.
Nice one,
Joelle. Appreciate you.
Pleasure, love.
Lovely.
This is Stephen Kilpatrick, host of Tales to Terrify, and you're listening to Slice of Sci-Fi.
I hope you guys enjoyed that little sneak peek at Writers After Dark, which should be fully underway hopefully sometime in the next week or so. And Joelle, thank you so much for hitting that junket and getting an awesome, awesome interview. Robert sounds like a lot of fun, and I can't wait to see him in Bad Samaritan and those other projects we talked about coming up. We're not going to talk yet about Avengers Infinity War. Give people a couple of more weeks to see it. The movie in its second weekend is still setting records. I love it. I love it. Sometimes there is joy in being an old school Marvel girl, but we will cross that Marvel bridge when we get there. I'm just as annoyed, upset, heartbroken by the events at the end of Infinity War, but you know, I have a long history as a Marvel girl. Nobody seems to stay dead for very long. So we shall see what comes of that. Black Panther will be coming out on Blu-ray and 4K Ultra at the end of May. I can't wait to get my hands on that, because the first deleted scene, you can actually see that on YouTube now. It's between Wakabe and Okoye, basically confirming they are a married couple. And I am like many of others saying, wait, why was that cut out of the movie again? I don't know. But yeah, definitely go check it out on YouTube. It's worth watching, and it adds a whole nother layer of just tension to the battle scenes at the end of Black Panther. So go check that out when you have a chance. But that will do it for this episode. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to call. The number is 602-635-6976. Or send me an email, summer@sliceofsci-fi.com. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on iTunes, on Stitcher, on TuneIn, and on Krypton Radio. If you're listening on iTunes or on Stitcher, please leave us a review. Those reviews do help the sorting algorithms over at iTunes and on Stitcher. So if you're enjoying the show, please leave that review. Let people know that you are enjoying the show, and maybe they should check it out for themselves. You can follow Slice of Sci-Fi on Twitter. We're Slice of Sci-Fi there. You can follow us on YouTube and on Facebook. We're Slice of Sci-Fi there as well. And of course, there's the websites, sliceofsci-fi.com and writersafterdark.com. That new show will be there post-haste, hopefully, if I can get my editing sped up. Thank you, everyone who's supporting the show. Your donations and your pledges do help. Every cent goes to keep everything online. The hosting, the media hosting, the websites, all of it is supported by your generous contributions. So again, thank you. And if you would like to also add your support to this show, you can go to the website patreon.com/sliceofsci-fi and add your pledge alongside everyone else's. If you'd rather do a one-time donation rather than a pledge through Patreon, there's a paypal.me link in the show notes that you can follow for that. And again, thank you everyone for your support, both in listening and in pledging to help keep things going around here. I'd also like to throw a shout out to my favorite geek rock band, Sci Fried, for the music that you hear in the show. If you like your rock and roll with a side order of geekiness, you can hear more music of theirs over on their website, sci-fried.com. And you can also check out some music videos they've done over on their YouTube channel, which I highly recommend. Especially, I think my two favorite videos are the video for their original song, the Star Trek 50th Anniversary tribute ballad called A Tall Ship, and their zombie-flavored parody of Johnny Cash's Folsom Prison Blues called Zombie Prison Blues. Yeah, it's Walking Dead related. You'll enjoy it, trust me. Check that one out, and next time you see the guys when they're out on tour, tell them Summer said hi. But thank you for listening. We will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.